Since 1954, one dictator after the other has bent the Guatemalan people to his will. But since the 23rd of March, 1982, the day in which Efraín Ríos Montt, together with a group of officers, seized power, the persecution has taken on the scale of genocide. Particularly in the northern provinces, where the EGP, the Underground Army of the Poor, operates, the military has carried out wholesale killings amongst the Indian population, razed entire villages to the ground, burnt crops, poisoned food, and butchered the animals.
Guatemala is the richest country in Central America, really, in terms of total product, national product, and it has the highest United States investment in Central America, but at the same time it's considered to be the country with the highest rate of malnutrition and the highest rate of illiteracy in the Western Hemisphere after Haiti.
In Guatemala we have a tiny percentage of people who are members of a ruling class. It is estimated that 1% of the Guatemalan population own over 76% of Guatemala's land. That 1%, which is referred to as the oligarchy in our common language, would be for the most part descendant of that Spanish elite, descendant of that conquistador elite.
The second in our two-part series of looking comprehensively at Guatemala, featuring two natives from that country, one a poet and school teacher, the other a professor and author. We'll look intensely at the Guatemalan society and the continued struggles of the people. Right now on Alternative Views. Alternative Views, we will again look at Guatemala, a country that's generally ignored by the regular media, although some terrible, horrible things have been going on there. We will continue with our interview with our two Guatemalan friends, Arturo Arias, who is a professor, has written books about his country, Jaguar in Flames, In the City in the Mountains, and he also co-authored the script for the film El Norte. Arturo is the editor of Voices of Mexico, a news magazine from Mexico. Simón Pérez is a Guatemalan campesino, poet, schoolteacher. He was forced to flee his native country because of the political violence there. Our translator is Marty Rumbaugh, and he occasionally will participate in our interview as well. We also will provide a sprinkling here and there of updated news stories with more current information on Guatemala. But first, former CIA person John Stockwell gives us some history on the country.
Guatemala, 1954. This is a cutie where the CIA overthrew Jacobo Arbenz. Arbenz was trying to buy unused land from United Fruit Company. Now, mind you, United Fruit Company owned Guatemala. Its government, its budget, annual budget, was larger than the government's. Arbenz wanted to buy the unused acres that United Fruit was holding and turned it over to the peasants, and they would grow bananas and sell them to United Fruit, so it wasn't really even hostile to United Fruit. Moreover, he was proposing to pay $2.98 an acre, which would represent 100% profit on their investment in the land, seemingly reasonable. The State Department stepped in and demanded that he pay $75 an acre, which was neither reasonable nor could the government afford to pay it. He couldn't do it, wouldn't do it, and proposed to proceed, so they castigated him as a communist, and the CIA organized a plot, and they ousted him. They took Colonel Armaz, who was a political nobody, and put him in power. And this is what our detractors would call a puppet of the United States. And he signed a sweetheart deal with United Fruit, and everybody was happy. Now, history and some research by a couple of New York Times journalists gives us an interesting little insight into this covert action. One, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Henry Cabot Lodge, had personal stock holdings in United Fruit Company. The Assistant Secretary of State, John Lodge, had personal stock holdings in United Fruit Company. The Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, his law firm did legal work for, I believe it's the Schlafly Bank, which held the papers on the Guatemalan Railroad, which was owned by the United Fruit Company. And the CIA director, Alan Dulles, was his brother, also was a member of the same law firm with this indirect financial interest in United Fruit Company. Arbenz was not a communist, and there was not a single communist in his cabinet. But they organized a coup and threw him out so that they could make some money on their investments.
At that time, Richard Nixon was Vice President of the United States and said after the overthrow, "This is the first instance in history where a communist government has been replaced by a free one. The whole world is watching to see who does the better job." Well, that was 30 years ago. Since then, the record is clear in Guatemala.
It didn't work. The next three leaders of Guatemala died violent deaths. Amnesty International tells us that 85,000 people have been killed by subsequent governments in Guatemala that are supported by the United States. This is not making friends for the United States in the long haul, I assure you. And United Fruit Company went bankrupt. The president jumped through a window of the Pan Am building and killed himself.
According to Alexander Coburn in These Times, the intervention by the CIA over 30 years ago has developed into a regime whose oppression is unequaled anywhere in the hemisphere. El Salvador, Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, they've all had their horrors, but there's nothing that can compare with the suffering that the Guatemalan people have undergone in the last three decades.
Since 1954, one dictator after the other has bent the Guatemalan people to his will. But since the 23rd of March, 1982, the day in which Efraín Ríos Montt, together with a group of officers, seized power, the persecution has taken on the scale of genocide. Particularly in the northern provinces, where the EGP, the Underground Army of the Poor, operates, the military has carried out wholesale killings amongst the Indian population, razed entire villages to the ground, burnt crops, poisoned food, and butchered the animals. It's a strategy which Ríos Montt's predecessor, General Lucas Garcia, initiated, namely to drain the sea in which the fish, that is the guerrilleros, swim. But that doesn't seem to be the whole story. Northern Guatemala is rich in oil and nickel, making it an attractive target area for foreign capital. The scorched earth strategy has started a mass exodus all along the Mexican border, which hasn't stopped since June 1982. Official estimates talk of 40,000 refugees. The unofficial put it at 100,000, living here in the pathless mountains and jungle, in camps, or by Mexican peasants.
Buscando refugio.
The poem is called Seeking Refuge. All of the people walk sad days, bitter nights, in search of refuge to save their lives. Crossing the immense and mysterious jungle where the persecution is constant for the young ones and children, and the weak, tired elders in the long journey, seeking foreign borders to save their lives. All the people seeking refuge, the humiliated, punished, and massacred Indians, Latinos, unappreciated and exploited, who lose their origins and customs in an unknowable world with a wish to save their lives. What suffering of races, prisoners in clandestine jails converted into cemeteries by the cruel tortures of powerful families who enslave the people to increase their wealth. Races which inherit from their grandfather Mayan, who crossed to foreign lands carrying a wounded soul, have said the ultimate goodbye to their people with tears which moisten their calloused cheeks for the sad memory of their brothers who didn't save their lives. All the people traveling to the country of the Statue of Liberty, where the persecution is the same for the harvesters of sweat and suffering, inheritors of an ancient culture, enviable artisans, eternal foreigners condemned to death, seeking refuge to save their lives. Thank you.
Some people have estimated that over 1 million people from Guatemala have been displaced, either within the country or having to flee to other countries.
The army had come to San Francisco de Nenton and wiped out the whole village. Well, there were three survivors, and those three survivors put together a list of 352 people that had been killed. And the people in the camps we visited had come from surrounding villages.
Go into their houses, cut them up with machetes, put them in buildings and burn the buildings, bomb the villages, acts of individual torture such as using machetes to cut people's limbs off slowly, one bit at a time in front of their families, killing and decapitating women, killing children with bayonets, disemboweling people. Stories are endless. There wasn't a refugee that we talked to that didn't know about what was going on and didn't have some direct experience with what was happening there.
In 2 weeks, anybody that would return to Guatemala was immediately massacred. We've had reports of people being tortured on the borderline, being their limbs cut off piece by piece as they were tired, and the last thing that has been cut off has been the tongue for the refugee camps to hear them scream until they die. And this is on the borderline, so that the refugees in Mexico can hear them.
They are orphans. Their parents were murdered by Guatemalan soldiers. The faces of these children betray little of what they've experienced. In Armaca, or Nazombra, the biggest camps for the makeshift school, the children have drawn pictures which tell more about their suffering. Since 1954, more than 100,000 Guatemalans have been murdered by the military or by paramilitary organizations. Continual human rights violations led even the USA to stop military supplies in 1977. Until then, the USA was always ready to help the dictators with weapons and CIA support.
Well, and it's terrible to think that when we send $1 million down there, or when we provide funds to train these people, or as we've seen, we have actually CIA, Green Beret advisors training their armed forces there, that it's going to massacre finally innocent women and children who are not even Spanish-speaking. Certainly they're indigenous and native people who are struggling to survive.
The United States media during this time has completely closed their eyes to the suffering in Guatemala, in our own backyard south of Mexico, and there's been no exposés of the suffering, of the oppression that the Guatemalan people have undergone the last three decades. In addition, according to Coburn, the media in the last year have created a fairy tale that things have changed under the first civilian government. Venicio Cerezo was elected president of Guatemala in January of 1986, and the media, fostering the line of the Reagan administration, has tried to make it appear that everything's okay now in Guatemala, that the oppression is over, that poverty is being alleviated, that the civil rights position is much improved. All of this is a myth and a lie, according to Coburn, who said that Cerezo's term in office has been a major disappointment to those that want reform and those that think that improvement has come about in Guatemala. This is simply not the case.
Este poema se llama La muerte de Oliverio Castañeda, un universitario.
The poem is called The Death of Oliverio Castañeda, who was a university student assassinated near the Central Park in Guatemala City. Persecution, torture, and death, surrounded by the security forces of the government of Guatemala, was Oliverio Castañeda. Thousands of students, workers, and campesinos were present in the Central Park to protest the injustices in which the country lives. In the center was Oliverio Castañeda. With a clear and strong voice, he denounced the enslavement of an entire people. Persecution began, capturing, torturing, the death of Oliverio Castañeda. All of the people were witnesses of the way in which one voice of hope was assassinated. The furious pain came to all of the country, making protest marches in the streets with black armbands and cries of repudiation moved by the cowardly assassination. In the hour of his funeral, thousands were present with red carnations, pale faces and tears, looking from one to the other with gestures of bitterness to say goodbye to Oliverio, not forever, but goodbye until soon. The doors of the sepulcher opened, and the wind blew soft and fresh from north to south with the scent of white lilies and red carnations. The people made an immense circle, and in middle the tomb and Oliverio Castañeda. The first shovel of dirt hit the coffin, making a sound like drums announcing a battle, leaving the body completely buried, nourishing the land where ideas will be born like flowers of a thousand colors. The tomb remains shut, a name carved in stone. Rest in peace, Oliverio Castañeda. The rays of the sun begin to hide themselves like thin rapiers of shining steel in the mountains around the cemetery. No one wanted to leave. Speakers continue to cry slogans. Oliverio Castañeda has died, but his ideas will live forever. We continue his example. Forward, forward. Struggle is constant. Oliverio is present. The people united will never be defeated. Liberty or death.
Libertad o muerte.
Let's look now at Guatemala in greater detail. As we continue with our interview with Simón Pérez, campesino, poet, schoolteacher, and Arturo Arias, author of many books and articles. We talk about the social structure of Guatemala. I think the people generally don't realize, first of all, that the Guatemala has a minority government, just like South Africa has, and that there's tremendous racial prejudice and repression in the country. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. The majority of Guatemalan peoples are Indians, descendants of the Mayas, which is one of the greatest cultures that we've known in the Western Hemisphere, and a culture that from way back has stressed communal cooperation over individual competition, and that has lived in an inviolable harmony with nature and has all kinds of other values that we should rescue. Nevertheless, this population was conquered by the Spanish armies in the 16th century and has since been under one of the worst cases of exploitation, oppression, and discrimination that we've known of. Enslaved in the beginning, and after slavery officially became a no-no, then legal means to create pseudo forms of slavery were created, such as the what anthropologists call debt peonage, and means through that, which people were kept in the haciendas working as overexploited farm labor, mm-hmm. and obviously discriminated against, because the ideological justification to do that was that the Indians were inferior, and therefore it was their lot to do those tasks, while the owner of the hacienda, usually a white person descendant of the Spaniards, dedicated himself to just riding his horse through his property, surveying that everything was nice, and thinking about whatever those people think.
So this is, has left a legacy for what we have today in Guatemala, and what the mestizos, or the people of Spanish heritage, still run the thing.
In Guatemala, we have a tiny, tiny percentage of people who are members of our ruling class. It is estimated that 1% of the Guatemalan population own over 76% of Guatemala's land. That 1%, which is referred to as the oligarchy in our common language, would be for the most part descendant of that Spanish elite, descendant of that conquistador elite.
What are some of the forms of racism against the Indians? To begin, they're forced to learn the Spanish language.
They learn Spanish, and they're beginning to learn Spanish. Mm-hmm. They were actually prevented from learning Spanish. Because it was the fear of the Spaniards was that if they knew Spanish, they would know too much. And so while Spanish was the official language, and all legal transactions and all legal documents were in Spanish, they were prevented from knowing Spanish. Mm-hmm. So if they wanted to be represented legally, they would need to find a translator who would translate for a lawyer who would handle their affairs, assuming that they had economic access to a lawyer to start with. So that immediately has placed in a terrible situation of inferiority the entire Indian population. I think Simone has good anecdotes to tell about that. I'll give you just one. Given that now the bulk, after the Indians, the largest other group would be mixed Indian and Spanish people, which is my case, you know, referred to commonly in Spanish as mestizo, but in Guatemala we give them the name of Ladino. Mm. Among the Ladino group, sometimes you cannot quite tell the difference between Indians and non-Indians. And I have this wonderful Indian friend of mine who is very qualified. Her story is a story in itself, but she managed to go to university, very brilliant person, and apply to a particular job for which she was uniquely qualified in Guatemala City. She went and did the written exams and everything, and she was by far the best. She got the job the first day she showed up at work. She was wearing her Indian clothes. And they asked her, but why are you disguised? And she said, I'm not disguised. I am Indian. These are my clothes. Well, she was fired the next day.
Oh, my God.
Even though she was by far the best qualified person for that job.
Simone, what was it like to grow up in this culture like this as an Indian?
Bueno, para nosotros crecer en estas pequeñas aldeas mestizas es bastante difícil, ya que se tiene que conservar las dos culturas.
Well, for us to grow up in these small mixed race villages was very hard, since we were trying to conserve two cultures.
Y se está viendo de que la cultura de donde uno viene está siendo masacrada, está siendo destruida y al mismo tiempo es despreciada.
And you're seeing that the culture that one is coming from is being massacred, is being destroyed, and at the same time is being devalued, discounted.
Y cuando uno quiere conservar la otra cultura, pues se siente responsable de lo que le está sucediendo a los indígenas.
And if you wish to conserve or value your Spanish background, that's to feel yourself responsible also for what's happening to the Indian background.
Entonces ahí es donde uno empieza a pensar de que realmente uno tiene que tomar una posición como realmente guatemalteco y que debe de aprender un poco del ladino que oprime, pero conservar lo que los han enseñado nuestros abuelos.
And so one begins to feel the need to take a position as a Guatemalan to learn something from the Spanish culture, but to conserve and protect the culture, the rich Mayan culture that you've inherited.
Well, now, your mother was Latino and your father was Indian,
yeah.
Right? What, tell us their story.
historia de su mamá y su papá.
Sí, es una historia que realmente nosotros la pudimos sentir y vivirla, ya que se dio ese choque de dos culturas muy fuerte.
Well, it's a story that we ourselves lived and felt very strongly since we lived in the middle of this clash between two cultures.
Ya que cuando mi mamá se casó con mi papá, pues mi mamá fue separada de su familia porque dijo que era una persona que no merecía estar en la casa.
Since when my mother married my father, her family cut her off from the rest of the family and said that she was a person who didn't deserve to be in their house.
Y así como ahora nosotros, la familia de mi mamá no los considera parte de esa familia y nuestra abuela no los considera nietos de ellos, los dejó así afuera.
Up till now, my mother's family doesn't consider us a part of the family and my grandmother doesn't consider us her grandchildren.
Y ahí nos pudimos dar cuenta nosotros de cómo es el racismo contra el indígena y es por eso de que empecé a despertar la raza mestiza en que realmente tienen que tomar una posición de definir si realmente quieren ser parte de la clase opresora o defender la clase oprimida que es la indígena.
And living through experiences like this, we can learn very clearly what the racism is, see it very clearly, and thus it is that people who are mestizo begin to see very clearly that they have to either unite themselves with those who are oppressing or take a stand with those who are oppressed.
In fact, it seems like there are some similarities to the apartheid regime in South Africa in that a small minority seems to dominate the political and economic power and to try to exclude completely, in this case, the Indian population. Although you have the mestizos who are sort of in between, how does that confront the mestizos with a challenge to identify with one side or the other? Is that the way it works? Or
and that's the way it works, and that's what we've been seeing. Mm-hmm. Obviously, since it's also the struggle in Guatemala is simultaneously an ethnic one mm-hmm. and an economic one, in the sense that the Guatemala, it's a country in which the economic injustice is such that the gap between haves and have-nots is gigantic, much more so than in most other countries in Latin America and in the third world. Guatemala, a country that is rich in land and in natural resources, is considered officially the third poorest country in Latin America after Haiti and Honduras, and has one of the worst infant deaths. You want to say something, Mark?
I just wanted to throw in here, it's very relevant to say that Guatemala is the richest country in Central America, really, in terms of total product, national product, and it has the highest United States investment in Central America, but at the same time it's considered to be the country with the highest rate of malnutrition and the highest rate of illiteracy in the Western Hemisphere after Haiti.
This brings to mestizo question, because there, like I said, it's not purely an ethnic question. Mm-hmm. There's all these economic questions to address with, which have forced a great deal of the population to take sides with those who see a structural change of the system as the only means and the only possible answer for creating a country that would really represent the interest of the majority of the Guatemalan people. And this has brought about an alliance between sizable sectors of the mestizo population and the Indian population.
As I understand it, you were talking about Guatemala as a rich country, that the inner portion of the more western central portions of the country, they found that are very rich in untapped natural resources and productive land. So this is at the bottom of the repression of the Indians. The Indians are there, they have been working the land, as you say, and yet there are tremendous resources there, and of course they want to develop them, and the easiest way to clear the land, you have to clear the people first. And the easiest way is to kill them.
And to keep people there for exploitation. A case in point is what happened with the oil fields. Guatemala has oil. In the early 1970s, the governments, and obviously the military governments, brilliant idea as to how to solve the problem of lack of land for such a huge population was to encourage people to settle in the jungle areas of the country. So a lot of landless people moved into the jungles areas of the country and opened up that region. Mm. After it was opened up, the army moved in, seized those lands, which turned out to be the lands in which oil existed, started creating the oil wells, and obviously when that population rebelled, because it did rebel, it's part of the population that has been massacred, and still a bulk of that population is to this day concentrated in the model villages around Playa Grande, a town where two of the major jungle rivers meet and which are survivors of that whole colonization experience in that area.
And of course, these are the people whom the Reagan administration and the right-wingers and the religious right call communists.
Oh, absolutely.
Communist insurgents,
uh-huh. They call them. Absolutely.
In fact, this brings up one of the odd factors in the whole Guatemalan system, and that is the role of evangelicals from the U.S. There's a whole lot of Protestant so-called missionaries who go down there. And what do they do and who do they work with and what kind of a role do they play in the political system?
Okay, first, one step back. The bulk of the people that we've been talking about, for the most part, are Catholics. Mm-hmm. Maybe not Catholics the way Rome or the Pope understand Catholicism, because it's a mixture of Mayan religion with Catholicism, but they consider themselves Catholics. And very, very devout. So the Catholic Church has gone along with them in the process for demanding social justice and struggling for the betterment of the lot of the poor, putting into practice what they preach.
Liberation theology.
Liberation theology.
And here is a good example of why the power structures and the religious fundamentalists don't like liberation theology.
A priest has been organizing, he set up his own organization called the National Peasants Association, 42-year-old priest, and he's trying to get the government to start some type of a land reform. And very interesting, complex situation, because he has the backing of the peasants, and he figures now there are about 150,000 people in his organization, so it can create quite a wallop if it wants to. But in negotiating with the government to try to get land reform, they came up with a scheme not of land reform itself, because the priest knows that if they actually try to do that, then it would bring down all the repression of the government and the landowners. So what they're trying to do is come up with some type of way of getting more land in cultivation and then providing more agricultural jobs for the peasants and the Indians. Right now, 54% of the farmers are crowded into 4.1% of the country's cultivated land. And there are some 420,000 peasant families that are completely homeless. So really, the only thing that can be done is land reform. But they will never be able to do that without some type of really complete revolution.
And as a result, what the army has used is to ally itself with U.S. fundamentalist sects and bring in fundamentalist missionaries into those areas that, coming along with the army, have worked with the army for intelligence purposes, because a lot of fundamentalist missionaries have gone into these areas to find out who lived in what house, how many people lived there, how the houses were distributed, and this and that, and then passed on that information to the army. And that's no secret. They brag about it publicly in Guatemala. And then they have gone in with the army and accused the Catholics of being communists, saying that Catholicism equals communism, and that the only way people can be saved is if they become members of their church. And the bait for salvation is material goods. We're speaking of, to start with, very poor areas. But on top of that, the army came and destroyed the area, so it's even worse. And so the fundamentalists come with canned goods, with rice and beans and clothes and things like that, but they will only give it to people who join their church. So obviously a lot of people start joining, because not only they would get material goods, but also they would not be labeled Catholics, which equals communism in that area, and which it's an area in which to be labeled communist, you know, your life is very much in threat and probably is not worth very much. So people start joining in mass those fundamentalist sects, and then later they brag in TV programs in the U.S. about the enormous amounts of people who have joined their church in Guatemala.
Come and, to the Lord. Right?
Yes, and they invite General Rios Montt to appear in that TV program, 700 million, to speak about how he managed to turn the tide of red agitation in Guatemala and brought everyone into the fundamentalist fold and things of that.
And which groups are these? Is this Pat Robertson's 700 Club or Jimmy Swaggart or Jerry Falwell or all of them?
Well, we know at least explicitly of links of Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Oral Roberts.
Okay.
Those are documented.
Okay.
Probably the other ones are there too, but at least those are documented.
You see the Christian Broadcasting Network, you'll see Pat Robinson saying how they're helping to fight the communists down there and sending all kinds of aid. But it goes much further than that in a couple of ways. First of all, there is a lot of there are a lot of close relationships between the religious right, the State Department, the White House, and the people, the repressive regimes in Guatemala. Rios Montt actually met with the White House and with State Department personnel and with Robertson to formulate a plan so that they could provide this so-called private help to Rios Montt and the Guatemalan army and police. There is also a California-based fundamentalist right-wing sect called Gospel Outreach, which has been very, very instrumental in Guatemala, but it's just one of hundreds of eccentric sects that are stationed in Guatemala, but it's a very important one because Rios Montt was actually a member of this sect, and that's what made him a good born-again Christian. That means he's good. He's down there kicking them communist butts, so let's support that man. But what is even more pernicious about it, that it seems that this Gospel Outreach, according to Covert Action Information Bulletin of, let's see, well, I don't see the date on it. Anyway, number 27, it was a special issue on the religious right. But it said the people from Gospel Outreach took jobs in espionage and torture and accompanied Israeli and Argentine experts during these interrogation sessions. And there was a fellow who was interviewed by a Latin American study organization that was based on Chile. It's a civil rights organization. And they told how, even though he was a fundamentalist Christian himself, he was hauled into one of these interrogation centers, and he was tortured. And participating in this torture were some of these right-wing religious nuts. And after being tortured for a while, they said they were tired of doing so much damage to me, he said. I guess torturers got to take a break ever so often themselves. But he recognized two of these right-wing religious Americans who were there participating in this torture, and he begged them to recognize me because he kept pleading, say, hey, I'm not a communist, I'm not one of these guerrillas, etc. So finally he convinced these people that he was who he was, that he was a, and then they begged my forgiveness, saying, brother, we're Christians too, we're sorry.
So as long as you're a Christian, you're not supposed to be tortured. You're immune.
Well, it depends. Now, here's something I didn't know until I saw this article, that just being an evangelical Christian of and by itself didn't give you immunity from the death squads or from torture. You had to be the right type.
The right sect.
That's right, because there were 12 evangelical pastors were assassinated within the first 9 months of Rios Montt's rule. 69 were kidnapped, 45 disappeared, and there was a bloodbath of the wrong type of evangelicals.
So there was wars between these different Christian sects.
Apparently they weren't right-wing enough, or particularly what would happen was if any of these evangelicals, or and particularly the Catholics are the bitter enemy of these evangelicals, and they kill them, torture them quite frequently. But if they were helping to work with the poor or those in need, then they were automatically communists.
I see.
Here's a typical quote from a pastor there said when he was asked about the massacres of Indians and all, he said, the army doesn't massacre the Indians, it massacres demons. And the Indians are demon-possessed. And furthermore, they're communists. Getting back to the cultural thing, Simone, as I understand it, there are 22 different languages used in Guatemala, and many of these are Indian languages. Does this mean that there are, that the Indians really have 22 separate distinct cultures or just different languages?
A veces sí se nota que sí tienen diferentes culturas.
Well, sometimes yes, you can note cultural differences.
Ya que ellos pues en lo que nosotros se refiere, donde nosotros podemos percibir que sí tiene un poco de diferencia cultural.
One way in which we perceive some cultural differences that
es por ejemplo en el área del norte de Cobán.
Yeah.
Que son pequeños grupos, por ejemplo, de 10 millas alrededor se hablan tres diferentes lenguas. ¿Eh?
Is that there are small groups which in a 10-mile area can speak three different languages?
No se llama, ahí se habla Quechí, Bocón y Mang.
Quechí, Bocón y Mang.
Y pues realmente no se pueden entender y llevan sus diferentes ritos, sus diferentes vestuarios y bien interesante porque ellos tienen sus propias comidas típicas.
And the people will have different rituals, different clothing, different food.
Y diferente oraciones como pedirle al Dios que sí es universal en el 22 lenguas.
And different also prayers to pray to their God, which is universal in all the languages.
Does this make it difficult then for the Indians to be able to have a unified opposition to the Latinos and the government?
El indígena es bien astuto, es bien inteligente por herencia.
Indians are intelligent and are very astute, and this is something inherent in the culture.
Ellos conservan algo muy muy profundo de su cultura y se basan mucho a lo que es la Biblia de ellos, el Popol Vuh.
And they have conserved a great deal of their old culture and the belief and system of looking at the universe, which comes from one of their sacred documents, the Popol Vuh.
Y realmente son bien celosos con su cultura.
And they really guard their culture jealously, in reality.
Y ellos sí saben de que llegará el día en que ellos tienen que bajar a pelear para defender su tierra y su raza.
And they know that a day is coming when they have to fight, when they have to actually make an all-out struggle to defend their culture and their race.
Porque así lo tienen escrito.
Because so it is written in their book, the Popol Vuh.
And this is true of all the different Indian groups, so there's a basis for unity.
Eso es verdad de todos los grupos indígenas, porque hay un base para la unidad.
Sí, es el Popol Vuh.
Yes, okay. The Popol Vuh is common.
I would like to add to that all those languages exist, but they are all descendants of the Mayan branch, mm-hmm. of the Mayan family. It's sort of like the Latin family in Europe, where you get Italians, Catalans, French, Spanish, Portuguese, but they all come from that common Latin branch. It's the same in among the Indian groups. So the same way as the difference in languages signals different cultural evolutions, mm-hmm. through the years, there's still basic common cultural responses. Now, those cultural responses also have been more homogenized by the conditions of exploitation and oppression, where in the same hacienda, a lot of them have mixed and met the same conditions. And since the 20th century, they have also, through their own needs and efforts, started learning more and more Spanish. And one of the first demands that Indians always had to any group, Catholic group or whichever group that would come to help organize whatever type of grassroots organization was being created was to be Castellanized, because they know just how important it is for them to be able to speak Spanish to communicate among themselves. But I would also add that of all those 22 languages, four are dominant. Quiché, Cachiquel, Quechí, and Mam, and most Indians would speak one of those languages at least, so that they would already be bilingual in their own languages at least. Mm. By the time they get to Spanish, they are usually trilingual. Uh-huh.
And there are many cases of quadrilingualism.
And people who speak Quiché and Cachiquel can understand each other's language to a very great extent.
So man, poco man. Mm-hmm. También ellos son bien muy interesantes con nosotros, que estamos cerca de ellos.
And they are very, to those of us who are close to them culturally and geographically.
Porque ellos son bien claros, bien sinceros, y lo dicen de que ellos no los rechazan.
It's very interesting because they say very clearly that they do not reject those of us who are mestizo, who come from
que siempre culture. Ellos están con los brazos abiertos y nosotros queremos todavía conservar nuestra cultura.
That they always receive us with open arms if we want to help them in conserving their culture.
Y esa es una parte de que se llena uno con más fuerza de sentirse realmente un mestizo, donde ve las dos diferencias culturales.
And this is something that helps one really to understand oneself as a mestizo and accept being mestizo.
You have your roots in the traditions of the country and the culture. Isn't there also a black culture in Guatemala? In the Caribbean, there are some former slaves from Jamaica. Have they been assimilated into the country, or are they more separate or autonomous?
They're beginning to be assimilated right now. They had remained pretty much cut off from the rest of Guatemala through most of the time, because the Caribbean coast was very separate from the rest of Guatemala, and there were no roads, there were no means of communication. Since roads have begun to be opened up, which dates to the early 1950s, there has been much more assimilation, and now a lot of blacks have mixed with Indians in that area, especially with Quechí Indians, because it's an area into which Quechís have moved. I would also add that a lot of blacks from that area were hired by one of the few democratic governments we had in the 1950s, the one that was overthrown by 1954, to work as qualified workers for the building of the Atlantic Highway, so-called, which was that highway that connected Guatemala City to the Caribbean. And in the process of moving, since the highway was built from the coast towards the city, as they came down through those areas, they became many times the first blacks that a lot of people had seen at that time in those villages. Mm-hmm. Along those areas, and they were seen as exotic, and since there was no concept of blackness, they were not looked at with the same prejudice as the Indians were looked upon, and many of them married white Spanish women along that area, and that right. created a whole new segment that has evolved along the Atlantic Highway.
We jump now from May of 1987 to June of 1988 and look at news stories which show what the Guatemalan people are doing in their continued struggle. We also will take a look at Nicaragua and Brazil.
Apparently, there's some opposition that's really getting stirred up. And for the past 2 years, with priests and Indians and other people, there has been a lot of activity, anti-government activity. Is just amazing with all the repression that it could still exist. For instance, this is the February 24th edition of The Guardian. It talks about three massive political demonstrations of 30,000 to 50,000 people in January of 1988. And they made the same point after years of murderous repression. They seems that the people are beginning to get organized again, and there was a 50,000 strong campesino and Indian demonstration on January the 8th of 1988 in the Western Highlands, and that was the largest demonstration they've had in over 20 years. And in other parts of the country, there are not only these demonstrations, but there's a lot of military activity once again. It seemed like it was almost wiped out for a while, but there are street demonstrations, there were other places where they put graffiti on the walls against the generals and the right wingers. There are places where there are actually military activities. They're attacking and ransacking a police station here and ambushing a military patrol there. And as a result of this, the Guatemalan army has been counterattacking fiercely. They've been bombing Indian villages and spraying defoliants with U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency material, and aircraft, and pilots. And a reporter who wrote this particular article for The Guardian said that he watched several military helicopters land and discharge their battle-weary soldiers, their Guatemalan soldiers, and in the rear of every helicopter were U.S. advisors. You haven't seen any of this in the regular media.
Another story that hasn't been reported is the way that the Sandinista government has come to terms with the Mosquito Indians, and how almost all of the Mosquito Indians that previously were forced to become refugees and go to Honduras, and then even had joined the Contras and were fighting the Sandinistas, have now returned to Nicaragua and are living in peace with the Sandinista government. Around 1984, there was fierce fighting between the Mosquito Indians, some Contra forces, against the Sandinista government, and as many as 40,000 Mosquito Indians left their country and went to Honduras, where they were set up in refugee camps, and many joined the Contras. In 1985, some of the Mosquito forces signed some accords with the Sandinista government, and some returned, but in 1986, fighting broke out again. Well, recently, in conjunction with the Arias peace plan, most of the Mosquito Indian leaders have now signed peace accords with the Sandinista government, and most have now returned to Nicaragua. It's interesting that when the Mosquito Indians were having a big meeting to decide whether they should sign the peace accords with the Sandinistas, it was the CIA that was there trying to persuade the Mosquitoes not to go back to Nicaragua, not to sign the peace accords with the Sandinistas. And it's alleged that the very few Mosquitoes that are still part of the Contra forces are in the pay of the CIA and are being paid to continue to fight. But it appears that the rest have returned to Nicaragua and are now living in peace, and that regional autonomy has been granted them, so they're able to engage in self-government. This is, again, a story that just hadn't been reported by the American media.
There are some horrible things happening in the jungles of Brazil and Peru. On March 28, 1988, 14 Indians in the state of Amazonas were massacred by machine guns. Another 27 were injured. Well, there were about 120 children engaged in communal work when they were attacked by about 20 white men with automatic weapons. According to the survivors, the massacre was ordered by a local lumber merchant, the brother of the chief of police in a local town. The massacre was carried out by area lumbermen who were arrested by police but subsequently released despite eyewitness accounts of what happened in placing these people on the scene doing the dastardly deed. This is just one example of what's going on frequently in Brazil, in the tropical rainforest area. The recent government policies favoring penetration of the Amazon rainforest for economic development have led to increasing conflict between the Indians and the government. In the hope of heading off social unrest, the Brazilian government has encouraged colonization by hundreds of thousands of landless poor people who are a problem to them in the urban areas of Brazil. So they send them off to the rainforest, and then what happens is that they are pitted against the Indians who live in these areas. In the same time, the government tax incentives have encouraged the invasion of the area by large agribusinesses and mining companies, who not only violate the Indian territory and devastate the rainforests, but also terrorize the poor peasants attempting to gain a foothold, the people who were driven there from the urban areas of Brazil. It's a terrible thing that's happening there, not only for people, they're destroying the rainforest, and people are getting ground up. It's terrible. And it's not being reported on, of course.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before. where a government lies to a people, and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the gun to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments are killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lies in the balance.
And that brings us to the end of another Alternative Views. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. If you'd like to jot that down and drop us a line, we'd be glad to hear from you, and we'd enjoy answering you back. Goodbye.